All right. So as Micah had mentioned last week with this controversy, it ties to many things, clearly, and we're going to see that when you deal with issues of free will, sin. It affects pretty much all areas of humanity, what we refer to as anthropology. So it's often something in theology that you speak of, what is the basis for your anthropology? How you consider the doctrine of man? Who is man? What does it mean to be made in the image and likeness of God? How has sin affected that? And your anthropology then also impacts how you understand salvation, how you understand the life that is to come, how you understand the person and work of Jesus. So these things are always interrelated and sort of to me like a spider web. When you pull on one string, everything gets pulled at some point. So it's, you can never talk about the whole web at all times, but everything you talk about here is connected to these other things. So we'll link some of those ideas together. Just for review, Pelagius was a monk who came out of the British Isles at the time, and he would have been somewhat of a contemporary with Augustine, though probably had never met one another. And this controversy goes not just from Pelagius, but from his follower Celestius into a man named Julian from the area of Eklinum. Probably a few ways to say Eklinum, but Julian of Eklinum. He is the intellectual behind the Pelagian controversy as far as we're concerned. He started not just a pamphlet war, a book war. So Augustine wrote something, and then Julian would write something back, a couple books, and then Augustine would write a couple books there. And so back and forth, at the end of the day, they sort of exhausted themselves with all the things that they had written. And if you wanted to read all of those works, you could probably just read the first couple to get a pretty good idea of it, because after that, it's a lot of repetition, and then it just sort of gets nasty. Augustine wasn't as bad as Julian. Julian was really one for invective language. He constantly referred to Augustine as the Manichaean. The Manichaean is waiting. I'm going to get it. I'm walking forward here slowly. There we go. We're going to do this as inconspicuously as possible. All right. No one noticed. Perfect. Manichaeism was a heresy. It was a religion that Augustine had been a part of and had moved away from it. So to refer back to him as a Manichaean would be like calling a Christian a Buddhist or a Muslim or something, just constantly writing that way to poke at him and to get people not to like him. He would also say things like, Augustine is the most stupid of men. He would write, the detestable Punic. Punic was the area of North Africa. And so he would refer to him constantly as the African, like he's an African outsider. The detestable Punic quarreler. Those type of things. So he used this kind of language when referring to Augustine, who was, even at this time, was a great bishop. And people in North Africa and Italy understood him to be a man of high stature. So Julian, doing this, was trying to, this that personal attack against Augustine to lower him down in the eyes of many people. In many ways, it actually backfired against him. Other than in the East, the Eastern Church, which was Greek-speaking. So as Micah presented, the difference immediately comes down to how you view sin. Is sin an issue of the will? I can choose to do this or not to do this. Or is it a part of your nature? And fallen nature means, in a sense, if you want to get quite simple with it, you say, it is the nature of a dog to bark. You'd say, a dog doesn't have a choice whether he barks because it's his nature to bark. And for the Pelagian side of the world, that was a detestable way of looking at humanity. Like, no, you have a choice whether or not you bark, whether or not you sin. You're not made to sin, you choose. And that fundamental difference is where everything comes down to. So freedom of the will presupposes freedom of choice for the Pelagian side. That you can you can choose not to sin. And so in free will, you possess a perpetual possibility of willing and not willing. And Julian would even deny that you have motives that pushed you. And so this conception of the will, it follows that as a possession, it cannot be lost and it cannot be restrained or limited by sin. So that's contrary to Augustine's whole way of understanding sin. And this conception of sin implies that it entirely arises from free choice. So Julian, Augustine's counter writer, is attacking constantly Augustine's view of sin as hereditary, as an outflow of nature. And this is an anathema to him, because freedom of decision, is linked entirely to his understanding of anthropology. And so for Julian, he saw Augustine as a Manichaean, as this dualist, that the devil must be the creator and the lord of everything that is evil. In fact, he's even worse than a Manichaean, because he makes God the author and the creator of sin in some way. And so that's why he, again, refers to him as a Manichaean, both as a personal attack, but also because he thought some of this Manichaeanism, this non-Christian heresy, was finding its way into Augustine's theology. And so it was more than just personal as well. In that sense, there's a theology at stake here. And why it's so important, of course, is that this carries forward certainly into the Reformation and beyond for us. What is it, the issue of human depravity, human sinfulness? And for a Pelagian, your wrong choices might add some sort of rust, as it were, to this pure metal of who God made you to be, so there can be some rust, surface rust. I guess if it lives long enough, it would penetrate in, but you just think of that as more of, you can buff off the outer, because at heart is still this God-given sense of choice that you can at any moment choose what you're going to do. And for Augustine, this is entirely completely out of step. He saw there was such a dislocation, a tension, a discord between what God had originally intended and what we are now, that we live in this tension. There's this sense that our sin is always beneath the surface, even of the believer, that you're moving forward in that, but there's almost a lack of self-control. Now, for the believer, that's a little different. There's a growing into what Augustine says you will grow into. Pelagian said you start at. And the primary issue then comes down to, again, what is the nature of sin? So looking at that in terms of when we think about this issue of choice, because choice is at the center of all of this. And one of the things that when people, you know, ask me some of these questions, I would say that when you summarize choice as simply A or B, it's almost always too simplistic. To say that I have a choice of this or that, it means you strip away the psychology, the history, all the things that make you you. So for instance, you're on an airplane. The very theological and weighty question comes to you, chicken or beef? And you're, according to a Pelagian system, I got a 50% chance of choosing chicken, 50% choice for beef. That's what choice is, one or the other. Nobody has a 50% chance of chicken or beef, because now enters into your entire history of eating, how you feel on the plane, motion sickness possibly, the food that someone's sitting next to you. All these things come into play. You have an entire history that determine what you're going to choose. Now, it might be, you know, 75, 25%, something like that, but nothing's just 50-50. No choice is a simple choice. You who you are today, okay, what if God had put you in the 7th century as a Bedouin slave girl on the Arabian Peninsula? you would choose things very differently. And you had no control over any of that. So that's the issue is, okay, I think I'm choosing these things, but the reality is that I'm put into a life, into a family, to a country, to a geography, to a time that I had zero control over that affects my choices and even my beliefs. It's kind of one of those things, the same way. It's like we all want to say that we're going to be the person who, growing up in Mobile, Alabama in 1830, we would have been the ones that, oh, slavery is the bane of society. Good luck with that. How many people in Mobile, Alabama were saying that in 1830? Not very many. Because of the power of culture, the power of all things. So it's just like, well, I can choose be pro-slavery, anti-slavery. Well, not so much. The abolitionist North, same way. If you're coming from Rhode Island, your thoughts about that are going to be very different. And it wasn't because this Rhode Islander, no offense, Micah, is super righteous and holy, and the Southerner is just the scum of the earth. Both Bible-believing, both going to church, both, you know, understanding and learning their catechism, doing all these things. And yet they're poles apart on an issue like slavery because of all these things. So when we just simply summarize choice as choose A, choose B, nothing in life is that way. For Augustine, choice revolves, or around freedom revolves not around choice, but around desire. You are free in that you get what you desire. That you are not compelled. You are not forced to believe or to hold certain things. And even today, this is really kind of the crux when you want to get down to like Calvinist versus Arminian, those sorts of things, and the debates about this, really come down to what is the issue of freedom? Is it freedom to choose alternative possibilities? Or is freedom, I get what I want? And so if for you, choice is about alternative possibilities, then Augustine's view doesn't make any sense. This whole idea of a corrupted nature doesn't follow. But if you understand freedom as I get to choose what I want, then it makes sense. Nobody is compelling me to choose differently. That's Jonathan Edwards makes a pretty good case of this as well. A lot of these ideas that Augustine starts with are pretty wonderful in and of themselves, but 2,000 years, 1,500 years of reflection upon these, they get better. So if there's some sense like, that's not all that satisfying, well, do know that people have been thinking about these things for a long time, and everything develops. And so many of the seed formations of Augustine continue to grow with more interaction, more debate, more people bringing scripture to bear, and so they improve. But that was Augustine's basic position. So, questions? Julian really wanted to avoid the idea of motivations altogether because, again, it came down to you still have a choice and you can choose. In fact, you're fairly neutral in everything that you do. So you may choose selfishly one time, you may not another time, and each choice presents itself with that. And for Julian particularly, grace is a means of helping you to that end. It's not just simply salvation of self, but you can actually be assisted by grace to choose the right thing. So they're not void of grace. It's just what is the role of grace? For Augustine, it would be grace is needed to regenerate, to restore, to renew the heart. For a Pelagian, grace is something that helps point you in the right direction. It gives you an impetus, a move. So you may selfishly choose one time, but you may then another time choose unselfishly. So that's the difference. Yeah?
How does Pelagian frame original sin, the garden, Adam and Eve, and the curse?
So no original sin in Pelagian. And that was simply in the state of innocence, these two people had a choice while influenced by the serpent, and they could have chosen not to. Once Adam sinned in the way that he did in Eve, then that starts to bring into a change of society that helps affect humanity, but we are not tainted because of Adam's sin. So every individual is, in one sense, like an Adam, getting to choose whether or not he's going to sin or not. That's like the extreme Pelagian. I can't remember if Julian is quite there or not. So this idea that we've inherited any sin from Adam is completely gone in their system. It is important to know that in the Eastern Orthodox, the Greek, the Russian, anybody comes out of the East, and particularly at this time, they did not hold to original sin. Augustine is a beloved saint of the Western world, of Catholics and Protestants, not a beloved saint of the Eastern Church. He's recognized as a saint, so they got to acknowledge him, but they do so begrudgingly. Like, oh, there's some nice things he did, and we're not happy about the rest of it. And one of their main things they dislike Augustine for, and this is one of the arguments that Julian Pelagius made, it's like, hey, other people believe this. We're not the only ones. And they did have sympathizers in the Greek-speaking Eastern Christendom. They don't understand original sin as in an Augustine sense. To them, you have a stain of sin. So everybody has a stain, and that's the one that needs for baptism, is remove this stain. And this stain changes. The compass needle is bent this way. It's like you're pointing, you know, you got a wrong magnetic field somewhere, and it's pointing in the wrong direction. And so you need to have Jesus point you back in the right way. In the Augustine system, the needle's broken. You need a new needle. And they're like, no, it's not broken. It's just there. It just needs to be reoriented. And that's the Eastern view of sin. There is a stain, a reorientation that takes place. And Micah mentioned this word of synergy, that there's a mix of both God and man working together. And that's very much in the Eastern approach. But again, when I say Eastern, I don't mean Buddhist. I mean Eastern Christianity. When you read some of the Eastern fathers, my dissertation was on Chrysostom, John Chrysostom, and he was an amazing preacher of righteousness. He was a moralist in many ways. He really, you know, telling people to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and, you know, straighten up, fly right, that sort of thing. Whenever any scriptures, when he was preaching through a text, mentioned something almost to the offense of humanity, especially like Ephesians 1, dealing with predestination, Chrysostom and other Eastern writers, almost to a person, insert, of course we know this doesn't violate human free will. It's kind of funny because in the Calvinist world that we live in after this is that Calvinists typically get accused of being putting logic and philosophy over scripture. And that's like we're always smuggling in this other premise. The reality is most Calvinists, Augustinians simply just stay with scripture. There isn't, when it comes to those sections of in James, no one says, of course we know that, you know, man is incapable of choosing. No, they don't do that. They just preach the text in front of them. But for a lot of the people who hold to a really strong sense of free will, whenever the biblical text seems to indicate our inability, there's a parenthesis that they insert in there. Of course we know this is, you know, God will never violate our free will. So I just find that interesting. We, you know, the other side is the one that gets attacked with being the logic choppers and the philosophers. So Julian understood immediately the issue then was infant baptism, that this was one of the game changers for if Augustine understood that baptism was necessary to remove original sin, and Julian did not believe in original sin, why are babies baptized? He believed they should be baptized, but it was because certain divine gifts, spiritual enlightenment, were given to the child. They were adopted as a child of God, and they were ensured the transformation as members of the bodies of Christ in the liturgy. So two different reasons for why infants are baptized. And that continues to this day, certainly in the Eastern Church. They don't see it as wiping away original sin, but as a divine aid. And in one sense, there is a baptismal regeneration even in the East. Micah. Yeah. Yeah, it ends up being, in a similar way, a fancy dedication to that. So this idea of hereditary sin brings us into another arena in terms of theology. And so the two words being used here are basically, how is the human soul propagated? So is every individual soul individually created? Probably the largest group of Christians hold that. So a child is born, that soul is created fresh and anew. Or the word being used for the Latin word is traducianism. And what it means is that the soul is propagated from the coming together of the husband and wife in some way, that there is an actual ontology of beingness to your soul, that parents to a child to, you know, so... What would be a really crass way to put that? Sourdough bread. Take a little bit of the starter out, and the next bit of starter, the next bit of starter. So are we sourdough, or are we French bread made fresh every time? And Christian theology has never really come to a full acceptance one or the other. Dominantly, people believe in creation of the soul, not the handing down little bits of dough each time. Why that matters for Augustine, went back and forth on this. At the end, he was a creationist who was like, I'm not really sure I'm right, because his system makes way more sense if you believe in the propagation from one to the next, the sourdough, because then sin actually has its own sort of ontology, being. It has a being to it. And if you're arguing that sin is not simply a choice between A or B, but it's a nature, then a sin nature, having each one affected that way all the way from Adam down, fits a little better with what's referred to as traducianism. And most of the reformers are creationists. It's kind of those things, everybody's like, yeah, I lean more this way, but I really understand that. When Micah referred to our understanding of sin as a representative sort of federal head, that fits with creation. So I don't have to be organically, physically connected to my past, if I am under the umbrella of representation for that, then each individual can be created at birth. So that's one of those where we come from things. It's typically not a huge debate in most Christian circles, and a lot of people don't really think about it one way or the other. The idea, though, of course, is sin something? And Augustine's view of sin is that it's a privation. It's not something. It's not doing the good. But most of the time we think about sin, it's hard for us not to conceive it as a something. It's like, what is it? Why am I orientated more towards my selfishness than towards my generosity? What does that? What is that thing that moves me that way? And I've used this before as an example. When you think of sanctification, the ongoing war of our souls, it is when you become a Christian, the skunk of your sin is removed from your heart, but the smell lingers a long time. You know, we're dealing with the smell of sin. But at some level, then you're like, well, isn't a skunk a thing? Even there, we're still stuck with, when we use analogies, we're like, it seems like sin is something, not just a privation. And I don't think ultimately, you know, there's been a satisfying answer to that. There's a lot of these things that are just simply outside of our pay grade. God has not revealed enough of these things for us to know. We just know the effects of it. And this is one of the things for Augustine that was so clear to him, is simply war against your own heart and see how you do. that these desires aren't what you want them to be. No matter how much you want to choose the right. And he recognizes that. Not only that, that's one of the emphasis of Augustine's on resurrection. He emphasizes resurrection all the time. Why? Because we need to be reborn. We need this transformation from deadness to life. That continues throughout. There's a growth that takes place in our sanctification, but that is one of a long process of this healing that is there in the human soul. And even the liturgy helped Augustine, because one of the things that they did over and over again in their song and their worship practices, have mercy on me, O Lord, have mercy on me. That was a part of their regular worship practice. And if you're asking God to have mercy on you all the time, it's because you need mercy. It isn't like, God, help me to bolster up my chooser because, you know, I'm going to choose better each time. And no, you go to have mercy on me. So in a sense, public opinion was on Augustine's side too, because of the struggles that we all have. And that for Augustine, freedom can only be the culmination of this process of healing. He said this, he says, some men try hard to discover in our will what good is particularly due to ourselves that owes nothing to God. How they can find this out, I just do not know. That baffled him. Like, what good thing is there in you that's outside of God? There isn't one. And this is why he speaks of the reorienting of the desires. He said, give me a man in love. He knows what I mean. Give me one who yearns. Give me one who is hungry. Give me one who, far away in this desert, who's thirsty and sighs for the spring of the eternal country. Give me that sort of man. He knows what I mean. But if I speak to a cold man, he just does not know what I'm talking about. The sheer irresistible pleasure of the object of our love, that motivation. Again, where Julian was trying to avoid motivation, just choose A or B, Augustine was talking all about our motives. That there's a sense of a disintegration of the will. That it's not what we want it to be. And that we will for the wrong desires, but not under compulsion. We get what we want. So this was the warring that takes place. North Africa is solidly in Augustine's camp. Italy, which is Latin-speaking, mostly is in Augustine's camp. And the eastern side of the world, one wasn't even aware the debate was going on that much. And they were probably more sympathetic to Julian as a whole. The weight that Augustine carried, the bishops of North Africa and the clergy coming out of Ambrose of Milan in Italy, was a part of what people, there's sort of this sense of all the important people believe certain things, that's good enough for me. Now, before we condemn that, that's how most of us hold most things. We all have authorities in our life who know things that we don't, and we're like, I trust them because I don't know how to make my computer work. I don't know how nuclear fission works. I don't know how that little machine gets this little machine a little picture on the screen. I mean, think of all the complex things that we have in our life that we just trust somebody tells us. Well, in a similar way, a whole lot of people where I trust who these people are, and Julian, who is he? And he's not only that, he's kind of mean and nasty in the way that he writes towards this venerated bishop of Hippo. So he was not an easy person. He was rather unpleasant at times, Julian. And he devoted himself to ridiculing the ideas of his elders. He is also one who wrote quite leisurely in a foreign country, and Augustine was a busy bishop who was dealing with real people and real struggles in a pastoral office. Julian was not. So the whole tide in the Western world was fitted and geared towards Augustine. The liturgy made sense to people. People understood their sins. And that was another area where, particularly for Julian, was the area of human sexuality. For him, he thought it was just crazy that Augustine thought that just sex in and of itself could be evil. Why would we think that a husband and wife, the act of of procreation would somehow be tainted with sin. There's no need for it. You're neutral. And for him, that thought of this every time you have two people sleeping together in a marriage bed as any kind of evil is just an anathema. Probably think Augustine went too far with his understanding of concupiscence, but at the same time, when Augustine's looking at human desires and why we do what we do, the best of our desires are always tainted. So even something good and godly and wholesome, there's still always an element there of our own selfishness, misdirectedness, and Augustine's simply pointing that out, and I think most people could understand that. Even my best days, I'm not fully what I want to be. And I think in terms of human sexuality, the illustration I've used is like nuclear energy. Nuclear energy can get a giant aircraft carrier going around the world multiple times for 2 years without refueling, and nuclear energy gives us all the catastrophes we've ever seen, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and all the reactor leaks. And most people come out with some degree of radiation burns in terms of their sexuality. And most people recognize that. So they're like, oh yeah, I could totally see where there's problems here. But for Julian, he could not. Yeah. The largest issue then, which is still the problem for anyone dealing with Augustine's view, comes down to, and Micah mentioned this last week, God's justice. How is God just? How is the understanding of predestination, any of these things just? If there's nothing you do, it's all God. And that was, and it still is, the strongest argument from Julian's side of life, from an Armenian side of life. What do you do with the justice of God? And for Augustine, he just simply said that we cannot think of justice rightly enough to be able to judge God on this, that we simply leave it to God to be able to bring forth his justice even in this complication of sin. And that, again, it's always been, it is a weak point. There's a weak point in every system. Every system runs into a wall somewhere. And for most on the Augustinian side of life, it's, I would rather run into the wall of God's sovereignty. I'm more comfortable leaving that there than to the wall of human ability and freedom. Yeah. Yeah. And in God's answer to Job, he doesn't answer Job's question. So even that, the question he asked Job was like, why am I suffering? I'm a creator. You're a created thing. And all this stuff works at my command the way it's supposed to. And Job, at the end of that, was abased. And he stopped questioning God. But God didn't answer his direct question, even there. He just pointed to who I am. And that's something when you see in Scripture as well, with Abraham arguing over the fate of Sodom and Gomorrah. He said, will not the God of all the earth do right? The assumption, of course, yes, God will do right. And then he whittles them down to, you know, the smallest number of righteous people that weren't there. So in the justice of God, he's like, sure, bring out to me some righteous people. I make it from a big number down to a small number. They weren't there. Which sets up, this is from Gerhardus von Rad. Wouldn't it be great if you're a school teacher and you had a last name von Rad? You'd be the cool cat. But von Rad, he said, Abraham didn't go far enough, because what if one righteous person could die for all the unrighteous? Not just I'm going to find some righteous and spare them, but what if one could die? That sets up the entire understanding of Jesus. And so even in the fullness of all this, you can't get away from the cross. The difficulties we have with human justice, God's justice, all these things constantly take us back to the personal work of Jesus, saying, God doesn't care about, the cross. Well, how can God, the cross? That Jesus takes on our humanity in its full extent, though without a sin nature, because the sin nature is not necessary to being human. It's fallen humanity. And so Jesus, the sinless one, takes on everything you and I are in the sinless state so that we could become like him, sinless. And that's the emphasis of Scripture. And that's what Augustine continued to point to. And in the midst of this, one of the things too, because the argument of predestination is to make everything very passive, it doesn't matter what you do, and that was not the case for Augustine. He was very much that this should activate you into service to God. There should be a growth in grace. There should be a doing. This is a freedom to do because God has set you free. There was no sense of just sitting back and, oh, well, whatever happens, happens. No, because God, now you have been set free in this healing process and sanctification to do. And one of the things, even when you deal with predestination, when you are in very tame and placid places of life, you can have this war back and forth. But when the world is crumbling in around you, one of the things that goes with predestination, and Augustine taught this, is preservation, the perseverance of the saints. That God has ordained that you will persevere in the end because his grace is from there from start to finish. And so when life is falling apart, there is a tremendous comfort in predestination, preservation. That God is going to uphold me to the end, even though everything crumbles. When things aren't crumbling, then you're like, well, it's not as important. I should have this memorized. Miroslav Volf has this great expression about understanding the justice of God, that basically in the quiet life of suburbia, it's real easy to doubt the justice of God, the problems of humanity. But go to the bloody war fields of Serbia, Croatia, and suddenly that changes your perspective. When there's this demand and cry for justice, like, God, how could you let these people get away with this? Because you've seen it firsthand. When you haven't experienced that, we're all like, well, you know, let bygones be bygones. We're all quick to forgive. It's like, no, not when someone has done something so terrible and audacious to you that changes things. You do want a warrior king to set things right. You do want the justice of God to trample on your enemies. But not from very placid feelings of quiet suburbia. Augustine is living in the fall of the empire. He dies on the eve of the Vandals besieging Hippo. The empire is crumbling. And the people who are experiencing these things, there is an immediate pastoral connection with the wonder and the greatness of the perseverance of the saints, of God's hand moving through history, which we'll look at in the City of God, that he is orchestrating things from beginning to end, even though it doesn't look like it. And so in that sense, the human heart is greatly aided by a God who can override it, who comes in and destroys that which holds us captive, as opposed to me quietly working out in the monastery, struggling with some kind of puerile sins that aren't really difficult. So that's one of the reasons, especially from this time going forward in the Western world, that Augustine has been such a champion of the nature of God's grace, of salvation by grace, of his mercy, of the resurrection, of the power of the living Christ to change the human heart. Not just give it a little nudge. It needs more than a nudge. It needs to be recreated. And now you're set free to actively pursue righteousness in the world. Not to sit back on your laurels and, oh, God will work this out. No, I am now a part of God working this out. Because in the sovereignty of God, he is now including you and I in the purpose of salvation to the world. And so it's your marching orders. And it's your victory card. Like, we win. So if I die before the end, who cares? You know, that's the point. It's like, charge the hill, because that death is going to be resurrected into newness of life. So it doesn't matter where you stumble and fall now. We know what happens in the end. And that was the heart of Augustine, pointing us to renewed desires and affection, having the Lord change the things that you love, that you would love new and better things, which is the person.